congressman from the 1st District. And we'd like to give a rousing welcome from the Crown College, and all these Tennesseans are here, to Senator Rick Santorum. Let's give him a great.
Thank you. Got the rock. Thank you very much. It's great to be in Knoxville. Thank you. Wow. This is great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Congressman Davis. Where did he go? There he is. Thank you very much for your kind words. Thank you, Pastor Sexton. Thank you so much for this. What a beautiful sanctuary, a beautiful auditorium. We appreciate so much the wonderful reception here. It's great to be in Knoxville, where I expect in about a week we're going to have a big win here in the state of Tennessee. Well, I'm here, if you saw this our talk last night, I'm here with one of the great women of my life, my daughter Elizabeth, who is here with me today. You can go back and sit down over there if you want. Thank you, sweetie. Elizabeth was with me last night. We had a much better night in Michigan than maybe was first reported. This was a really great race to go into, in a sense, the belly of the beast, the hometown of my chief rival here in the Republican primary. But even though he's my chief rival in the Republican primary, we are all united in one thing: we are going to defeat Barack Obama in the fall. Well, we had a much better night than was first reported, as it all turned out. You know, we went into this state, and again, you know, Governor Romney's home state, and his dad served there as governor for 3 terms, and family, and all this sort of stuff. And if you look at the state outside of his home county, we actually ran dead even in the state of Michigan. And here's the really important part: delegates, because that's what this is all about. And we actually won half the congressional districts, and so we're going to walk out of Michigan with 15 delegates, and he's going to walk out of Michigan with 15 delegates. We tied. So I'll take going in, getting outspent anywhere from 6 to 10 to 1. Either depending on the media story, either 6 to 1 or 10 to 1. We were outspent in Governor Romney's home state, where he campaigned exclusively and extensively. We went out there with a positive, hopeful message, a message about jobs, a message about energy, a message about faith and family and the importance of that as foundational institutions of our country. And you know what? The people of Michigan across the board, responded to that. And we're out of here today heading to Super Tuesday with some wind at our back, and it's going to blow. It's blowing out there right now, I can tell you that. But we have a lot of wind at our back heading here to Tennessee, and we're going to be taking it all across these Super Tuesday states, and we are going to have a great day a week from yesterday. I just want to say it's great to be back here in Knoxville. My first trip to Knoxville was actually to attend my brother's wedding. My brother got married here in Knoxville, and to a local girl who was a UT grad and went to graduate school at UT. So there you go. All right. Go Vols. So I had an opportunity to spend a lot of time here in the Knoxville area and visit her family, the the Simpson family. They were educators here in town and made great contributions here in this community. And we've got some. I've got some little roots here in Knoxville, and I know what a great, strong, conservative area this place is, and that's why we're going to do well here in Knoxville. And so we're going to come out and talk here in Tennessee like we are everywhere across this country. We are going to present an alternative vision, a really clear alternative vision, one backed up by a long and strong commitment to the principles that made this country the greatest country in the history of the world. See, I believe in this. I'm a conservative not because, well, it's popular to be a conservative running in a Republican primary. I'm a conservative because I came to it from the days when I first started in politics. I can't say that I was much of a conservative. I was more of an activist, just someone trying to stir it up on college campuses, and I didn't like the left, so this was the place to be. But it was over time with Reagan and after that where I continued to learn. And I even give credit to Speaker Gingrich when I was thinking about running for the House of Representatives. And as a great educator as he is, he's a great professor, and he talked a lot about those conservative principles. And so for me, it was this evolution and understanding the foundation of our country. And so when I go around and talk, I think it was important because it was important to me as a young person. It was important for me to understand, you know, who we are. Reagan did a lot of that education. I give Newt credit for doing a lot more. And I came to the position finally getting an elective office, and I realized how much was at stake, that this country and what was going on in Washington, D.C. was really, particularly within the Republican Party, we weren't really mounting any kind of real opposition when I came to the Congress in the 1990s. We were, at best, cheap Democrats. We didn't have any principled stand and vision for where to take this country. And that's a tragic thing for a party to be just about winning, just about doing a little better job than the folks that were there before. America needs strong, principled, and visionary leadership. Someone who... And we have an opportunity in this election. The greatest gift to the conservative movement is sitting in the White House right now, because he has given us an opportunity to see how far and how fast this country is running away from what made this country great. And I want to thank the people out there from the last 3 years who got off their couches in many cases, or even took time away from work and away from their family to get out and start reminding America about who we are and the important documents of this country. And that's the Tea Party. Without the Tea Party, this document, which I held up last night, this document, the Constitution of the United States, would be, well, what it was for many, many years up until the last few years, something just talked about every now and then, but wasn't central to the conversation, as it must be. Why? Because the Constitution is the operator's manual of America. It is how this country is supposed to be guided. It's the how. It's the how of America. And we've gotten away from that. We've gotten away from understanding how our founders put together this incredible structure of American government and why it works so well to build the greatest country in the history of the world. And now we have people who are running roughshod over this document. We have a president who finds it an inconvenience, and when he does, he ignores it. He appoints people to offices and ignores the provisions of the Constitution. He runs roughshod over rights that are guaranteed, freedoms guaranteed in this Constitution. whoever gets in his way, he is above the Constitution. We even have Supreme Court justices. If you saw the other day, Justice Ginsburg, one of the four on the court who routinely thinks that it's their job to rewrite the Constitution in their image. Well, she was asked the question whether she would recommend the United States Constitution to a country that was founding itself and establishing a new constitution. And she answered the question, no, she wouldn't recommend the United States Constitution. That it was an antiquated document. It was dated. It needed to be updated. It hadn't kept up with the times and new truths that were out there. And that a better constitution, this is a United States Supreme Court justice whose job it is to defend the Constitution of the United States, who said, no, pick the South African Constitution, not the American Constitution. And it's not surprising because more and more you see these justices and judges and people appointed by this president and others of the left looking to foreign governments, foreign constitutions, foreign treaties, international law, and trying to import that into the United States. Because, well, this document's just a little outdated. Ladies and gentlemen, if we plow under the Constitution of this country, if we plow under this document that protects the rights of all of us and keeps government limited, then we will be the generation that handed off an America that is nothing like what we were given. Nothing like what we should give. This document is important, but like in this little pocket constitution I have, there are other documents that usually are printed with it, one in particular, and that's the Declaration of Independence. And the reason the Declaration of Independence is printed with the Constitution is because you really can't have one and understand the country without the other. Because while the Constitution is the how of America, the Declaration is really the soul of America, the why of America. You know, in the Declaration, they mention God in one form or another four times in the Declaration of Independence. One of those times is mentioned in the key passage of this Declaration, which is at the heart of what America is. And that is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Think about that. First country in the history of the world that said, rights don't come from, they aren't given by, they aren't authored by courts or presidents or kings or emperors. No. This country said, we understand that rights are unalienable. They attach to you. They can't be given away or traded. They are because you have the dignity of being a creation of God, to have the rights that come with that. And of course, as you all know, with rights come responsibilities. What is that responsibility that our founders laid out in the Declaration? Well, the rights are right to life. Other rights don't much matter. Other rights don't much matter if you don't have the right to life. Liberty, the right to liberty, their order, the right to life, and then to go out and have the freedom to be able to pursue your dreams, to pursue the things that you're called to do. Originally, our founders thought about the idea of writing life, liberty, and property. In fact, other documents at the time used that term. But our founders rejected that. It wasn't enough. It was insufficient because property is about stuff. It's about something that, well, it's good. Economic rights are important. But liberty is more than just accumulating and having the right to get your stuff. They put the sights at a higher calling. A higher calling. Happiness. Now, when we think of the word happiness today, we're thinking, well, is that a higher calling? Go out and do what makes you happy? Go out and seek enjoyment and pleasure? Because, of course, that's what we think of today when we think of happiness. Things that make you feel good. But our founders had a fundamentally different understanding of that word. Because they understood what true happiness, what process it took to create true happiness. And if you actually go back and look up the dictionary definition of happiness at the time of our founders, it was even there. But it was something that was discussed and written about. Happiness was not going out and doing whatever you want to do to make yourself feel good. Happiness was not doing what you want to do, but doing what you ought to do. Because that's what leads to true happiness. God-given rights to exercise those rights in conformity of what you ought to do, what is morally right to do. At the core of America, what makes us this unique country is a moral enterprise. That's what America is. When people talk about the importance of faith in America, it is important. But at the soul of America is this American creed. It's not a particular religion, sectarian at all. It's this idea that we are a people that are called to something greater than ourselves. Think about that noble cause that is America. And it did ennoble us. The idea that we would be established with God-given rights and created this Constitution, which was Constitution that created or established certain freedoms for people to go out and pursue their dreams and build with limited government. Read this document. Limited government. And at the days of the founding of our country, the federal government was an afterthought. No one went to Washington to solve any problems. They took care of it themselves. They built strong families and churches, schools, civic and community organizations, hospitals, things to provide and care for themselves. They built America from the ground up. And that's how we were able to solve most of our problems. We didn't need Washington, D.C. That's what made America different. That's why it's been so hard to transplant these two documents in any other country in the world, because most of the other country in the world, they don't have that experience. Their countries weren't built that way. They were ruled. And so many people around the world look to America as this beacon of hope because, we weren't ruled. We believed in this great system of building a nation from the bottom up. Ladies and gentlemen, that is what's at stake in this election. And if you look at everything I'm going to talk about today and every problem that confronts America, it's a question as to whether you want the government to establish laws and rule you and tell you how to run your life, how to reallocate your resources through them to who deserve it more than those who paid it. That is the issue in this election, and there is no bigger example of that than Obamacare. I would not be in this election. I would not be running if my sole and principal focus in this race is to repeal Obamacare in January of 2013. And we can do it. We have to go out and make the case to the American public. Remind them, with the stories I've just talked about, who we are, what made us great. We have a healthcare system in America, I agree, is broken. It's broken not because we built a healthcare system from the bottom up. It's because our healthcare system is broken from the top down. You see, bottom-up means we believe in free markets. We believe in transparency. We believe in individual choice. We believe in all the things that created this dynamic free market that transformed the world and built the industrial age and now the knowledge-based economy that we have today. Competition and people understanding how to engage and improve and have the market, you, the consumers, respond. Picking products that you like better, knowing, as consumers, what best meets your needs. That is not the healthcare system in America today. The healthcare system in America is basically managed by government already. Medicare and Medicaid, big government insurance programs, comprise about half the marketplace. And then the other half is micromanaged by government. Federal mandates, state mandates, already in place. Requirements in the tax code that give all sorts of incentives for certain types of insurance through employers that greatly benefit. It's a very regressive system. It greatly benefits employees who are usually higher income that have very generous health care plans. No one would design this system today. But that's the current system. And what did Barack Obama do? He made it worse. He took more government control. The reason the healthcare system is so dysfunctional is because it doesn't include you, the consumer. It doesn't allow the marketplace to work. When I saw that when I came into Congress and got involved in the issue of healthcare, I put forward the solution. Oh, there were a lot of Republicans who were out there saying, no, we have to have the government come in and mandate health insurance. I said, no, I've got a better idea. How about getting 300 million consumers involved in the healthcare business? And I proposed something called health savings accounts. See, on the big issues of the day of government control, I'm always looking, and I've always looked, as to how we can empower you, not the government. If you're looking to see what a conservative really means, when they go out and argue for positions, it's always about who has the power in America. I'm not running for this office because I want to be the most powerful person in America or the world. I'm running because I want to return the power that's gone to Washington back to the American people. I guess Tennessee likes that idea. We have to have a candidate in this race who can make this argument, who can talk about not just their history, but their vision, contrast it with a president who doesn't believe in you. He wants that power in the hands of government. He wants to control your insurance policies and your access and the reimbursements to doctors and hospitals and how much insurance companies, not how much they'll make, how much they're allowed to keep of the money they collect. Well, that's already in place, by the way. Federal government has a regulation in place already that tells health insurance companies how much money they're allowed to keep of what they receive in revenues. 15%, that's what they can keep. That's how they can, how much money they get to keep to run their business. The federal government is now telling businesses how much money they have to spend in delivering their product. So why was it a surprise to see these HHS regs? They're going to micromanage everything because they don't believe in you. They think you're incapable. It's too complex. It won't be fair. You won't allocate it fairly. Some people will get more and others. Some people have better health care than others. Of course, the best way to do is make sure everybody gets the same. So that's what America's about, according to President Obama. Is the failure of America is that we haven't redistributed wealth equitably enough. And that's the job of the government. Well, the health care plan we put forward is a sharp contrast. I'm the only person in this race who can provide that sharp contrast. I didn't advocate for a government mandate. I didn't advocate for a government-run healthcare system at a state or federal level. I advocated for free markets. I believed in you. And I still do. I still believe that that's the best way to be able to allocate resources, to liberate you, and believe in you. Unfortunately, the others in this race who don't hold those positions in the most important issue in this election, we see now 75% poll out yesterday, 75% of voters, not Republicans, of voters in the swing states that are going to decide this election, 75% oppose a federal government mandate of insurance coverage. Now, why, as Republicans, who don't believe in mandates, who believe in free people and free markets, who believe in bottom up, why would we even consider nominating someone who supported government mandates, who supported top-down government control of the healthcare system? Why would we give this most important central issue of the government taking over 1/6 of the economy of the country, dictating to you all of the economics of how you're going to consume healthcare, and then dictate it to you going even further? Because, of course, as the government can dictate to you how you're going to spend your resources, why can't they dictate to you things that, well, may get in the way of your religious practices? Why can't they say that, you know, they know better, and they're going to enforce their point of view? If they can tell you, well, here's how much money you're going to spend, here's how much money you're going to have to spend on healthcare, and here's the policies you're going to get, why can't they tell you what those policies cover and force you to cover things and pay for things that are against your religious convictions? Why not? The government knows best. They know what's better for you. Why should religion get in the way? Nothing else gets in the way. Liberty is something that, of course, in their mind is not God-given. It's what the government says it is. That's why this issue is so important and why we can't give it away, because it goes to the heart of whether we will be free people after this election. We need a president who's going to go out and talk about how we're going to use markets, free people, to get this economy going. Obamacare is crushing not just the healthcare sector, but all sectors of this economy because of the specter of this new burden and responsibility. Taxes already being put in place, regulations, and folks are nervous. They're unwilling to invest. Well, that's the case in a variety of other areas. Right now, we're seeing a spike in energy prices. Gasoline prices on the way up, creating a headwind from an economy that's already burdened with record levels of government intervention. But there's probably no area that there has been more government intervention, aside from Obamacare, than the area of energy. And typical of the president, when these prices go up, he holds a speech and blames everybody but himself. Right? It's not his fault that his EPA is raining terror over anybody that dares talk about burning any kind of fossil fuel, because, of course, his EPA believes that CO2, carbon dioxide, is a toxin. Go tell that to a plant. This is the politicization of science. This isn't about climate change, climatology. This is about political science, not real science. This is about putting in your ideology, which puts man not as dominion over the earth, to be able to use earth responsibly as good stewards of God's creation. With an obligation, not just financial, but a moral obligation, to leave our country and our world and our environment better than we found it. That is our obligation. But their ideology puts man in a position where he serves the earth instead of the other way around. You see, that is an ideology that puts all sorts of crazy rules in place, like diverting water out of a river in California for a smelt that is putting thousands of farmers in the Central Valley out of business, destroying the economy of that region. Why? Because we put the earth above the needs of man. This is a president with the oil drilling and gas, who has shut down federal permitting for all of those activities offshore on federal lands, imposes it in Alaska in the deep water. And even when there's private sector development, which there's a lot of, he's now going out and threatening that this new technology called hydraulic fracking is a danger to the environment. And we need to think about whether we're going to control this or not. You know, when the first hydraulically fracked wells were put in place, shortly after World War II, we've been doing hundreds of thousands of wells in this country have used this technology at varying depths. And yet now, because it is successfully creating cheaper energy with respect to natural gas. Do you know natural gas prices in this country are 1/6 to 1/9 of what they are around the rest of the world? Because hydraulic fracking has opened up these gas shale, released these gases through this fracking process, breaking up the gas under deep underground. And now our natural gas prices, your energy prices, one of the reasons manufacturing is starting to grow now again in America is because we have the cheapest natural gas in the world, by far. And so what is the president doing? He's threatening to shut it down. After 60 years of understanding how this works and works successfully, the president of the United States, because of an ideology, he sees carbon in the ground not as an asset to lower the cost of energy, to improve the quality of everybody's life. He sees it as a liability that he has to keep in the ground. And then he goes out and says, oh, it's the Republicans who are having oil prices and gas prices he wants to buy. We need someone who can call him on it. Somebody who can go out and Somebody go out and hold up a piece of rock, like I did last night in my speech. This looks like a piece of coal. Tennessee knows a little bit about coal, right? And this looks like a piece of coal, but it's not. It's a piece of oil. This is what, under thousands of feet of ground, under pressure when it's pulverized, leaches oil out of this rock. Light, sweet crude, that's what comes out of here. The best oil to refine in the world, the premium product. I got this piece of rock from North Dakota. North Dakota can be a boom area, a huge boom area to create great oil reserve, great oil production in this country, but it is not growing nearly as fast as it should be. Why? Because President Obama won't build a pipeline so their oil can get to market, called the Keystone Pipeline. On day one, I will sign an order to build the Keystone Pipeline. Jobs, lower energy prices. To most people, 20,000 jobs and lower energy prices and creating economic opportunities throughout the Midwest would be something that would be a no-brainer. But not if you're driven by ideology, and not if you don't see lower energy prices as a good thing for America. He won't go out and say it. He can't say it. He just acts it and then blames somebody else for the problems. He still harbors this ideology of carbon is bad. Well, I never bought into the global warming when it was the popular thing to be for. But unfortunately, with respect to the other folks in this race, I am alone in that regard. Governor Romney has suggested that, well, actually, when he was governor of Massachusetts, put in place the first, he proudly crowed, the first carbon cap, CO2 cap, on power plants in Massachusetts. And talked about, up until just a few months ago, man-made global warming and the threat to our economy and to the world. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to have someone who has the courage to stand up when all are speaking falsehoods and everybody is buying into it in the elite media, and have the courage to stand up and be unpopular and say, no, that's not true. And there are other areas, too, that we have to have the courage to stand up and fight the establishment in Washington. And we've got the track record to do it. And that's cutting the federal budget deficit. We will balance the budget in 5 years under a Santorum administration. It won't be easy. People say, well, it can't be done. I mean, you'll go to Washington, D.C., and you'll try, but it just can't be done. But what's the biggest problem in Washington, D.C., when it comes to balancing the federal budget? Is it defense spending? No, it's not. No, defense spending is not the problem in Washington, D.C., although if you looked at the president's proposals, you would think so, because that's the one area he seems to relish cutting. He's cut $500 billion, and he wants to cut another $500 billion. Under my watch, we will not cut defense spending in this country. It is the number one priority of the federal government. It is the only thing the federal government must do. It is our sole and principal priority. Why? Why would we go after the thing that is the only thing the federal government can do that the states and locals and you can't do? Why would we cut that first? The only reason you might would say, well, it's this huge thing and it's growing so fast. Well, let's look at the facts. When I was born, the defense budget was 60% of the federal budget. It is no longer 60% of the federal budget. It isn't 50, it isn't 40, it isn't 30, it isn't 20. It's 17%. The most important function the government is supposed to do in Washington, D.C., defend this country. And only 17%. And we only spend 17% of the budget on it, and according to the president, that's too darn much. No, we need to spend more money on creating programs that foster dependency, that redistribute wealth. That's the goal. If you don't believe that, let me share a quote with you from about 8-9 months ago. President Obama's responding to Paul Ryan's budget that was submitted last spring. And he gave a lecture about all of these wonderful programs that Paul Ryan was going to cut or change. Programs like unemployment insurance and food stamps, housing programs, Medicaid, Medicare. He listed them all and said, America's a better country because of these commitments. And then he read off his teleprompter. I will go one step further. America was not a great country until these commitments. So the president of the United States did not believe America was great until people came into power in Washington, raised your taxes, took your freedom, and then redistributed your hard-earned dollars to someone that Washington believed deserved it more than you did. In his mind, that's the greatness of America. That's what makes America not different or great. It's what makes it like every other country in the world. And by the way, all of us came from those countries because we didn't want government to take care of us. When my grandfather came to this country back in 1925, there were no government benefits. Yet people still came. There were no government benefits except one. And this is why they did come. Freedom. The most important benefit. People say, well, Rick, how are you going to deal with all of these government benefit programs? Well, today those government benefit programs, those entitlement programs, don't comprise, as they did when I was born, less than 10% of the budget, or 20 or 30 or 40, but they comprise 60% of the budget. That's the area of government that has exploded, and President Obama has added to that, now with Obamacare, which will take that number to 60, 70%. That's his idea, more and more. Why does he want to shrink defense? So he can pay for more programs to create more dependency on people in power so you will re-elect them to take care of you. That's what he believes is the key. And he's right. It is the key. Margaret Thatcher said when she left the Prime Ministership of England, she was never able to accomplish what Ronald Reagan accomplished in turning America back from socialism, government control of people's lives. She said she failed. And she said the reason she failed, she couldn't break the dependency that was created by the British national healthcare system. And she and so many others of around the world have warned America that if we go down that road, where now every single American is dependent upon the federal government for their health, then liberty as we know it will be torn asunder. If you look at the Conservative Party in England today, they are to the left of the Democratic Party on most things. Why were the Democrats willing to run off the cliff and vote for Obamacare, knowing the public adamantly opposed it? Because they figured if they could re-elect Obama and have it implemented and have people become dependent upon government for their care, that within 10 years or maybe even less, they'd all be back, because this country will have shifted. That's why this is the most important election of your lifetime. It's about big issues. I know we have candidates running around here saying, oh, just talk about jobs, jobs, jobs. The reason we're suffering with a slow and bad economy is because the yoke of government is weighing heavily upon the people and the businesses of this country. You want to create jobs? Well, then create more freedom and opportunity for people to go out and create jobs and risk money. But the great thing about this narrative, that even if the economy does better, and I don't anticipate it will, I hope it does, but from the headwinds of this administration and what it's doing, every time the economy's gotten any wind, the Obama administration has found a way to stop it. Well, the economy may be good, it may not be good, or unemployment may be higher, may be lower. But if we have a candidate that says, well, that's a symptom of a problem, and that we have a broader vision for America, a broader vision for America that talks about foundational things and appeals to people at that foundational level. Why is Washington so split? It's because there are fundamentally different views of what the future of America should look like. And unless we can get a consensus of who we are as Americans again, that division will continue. This race must be about big things. It must be about who we are at our core. Because you know what? American is not an ethnicity. It's not a race. It's not a religion. We're all hyphenated Americans. So what is America? What makes us an American? Is it because we happen to live here in this country? Is that what makes us an American? Makes you an American is because you agree with a certain set of values of what America is. America is an ideal that changed the world, that I talked about earlier, that believes in limited government and free people, believes that yes, you can build a great country. One person, one family, one school, one business, one church, one civic and community organization at a time, and built a great nation solidly on a foundation that works for each person without looking to the government to provide for them. If we can get a consensus in America that's in fact what the kind of country you want to hand off to the next generation, then not only can we win this election, but we can have a consensus to govern by. This election must be about big things. And of course, the central part of that is liberty. Our founders, when they signed that Declaration of Independence, they signed it knowing that the chances of them succeeding in breaking away from Britain was very small. British were the most powerful nation on the earth, most powerful army and navy in the world. And King George III was going to have none of this country breaking away. We had a ragtag army of volunteers who step forward just like they do today. Yet they signed those documents. That document. Why would someone of wealth and property and prestige and even position as these men had, why would they risk it all, put their necks literally on the line for something that seems so remote of a possibility. We look at the situation today and we say, oh, America's really in trouble. Will America ever be able to fill in the blank? Compared to what our founders were looking at, this is a lay down hand. There's no reason to lose hope here in America. We just need to believe in ourselves. Believe that the principles we stand for will touch the hearts and minds of people who, in spite of their economic condition, in spite of the problems they confront, still believe in what made America great and what can again, and that they can be part of this renaissance in America. Our founders believed that. They were willing to put their lives at stake for that belief. And they wrote that we pledge to each other. Really interesting term. But they pledged to each other because they were bonded together in a common mission. If you look at how we succeed in America, whether it's in business or in our military or in our community, we are bonded together and pledging to each other. We're in the foxhole together. And they pledge to each other their lives, their fortunes, sacred honor. No one is asking you to pledge your life here in the next week or in the next several months between now and the November election. But I thank God that every day men and women step forward, put the uniform of the American military on, and do put their lives on the line for our freedom every day in America. Your lives are not at stake as citizens participating in the political process, thanks to them, thanks to our founders, thanks to the generations before us. And your fortunes, I'm not asking you for your fortunes. Although if you go to ricksantorum.com, there's a donate button. I always say the greatest gift you can give your children is the gift of freedom. But I am asking you, I don't even have to ask because it is not something that I need to ask. Your honor is on the line here in America. We have been given a great inheritance, this generation of Americans, from the greatest generation and from others who continued to keep that flame burning, that flame of freedom. We have been given a great inheritance. And we are at an inflection point in history where that flame could go out and we could be a very different country after this generation has made its impact on America. In that sense, your honor is at stake. You have been given much. You've been given a name, a family name. You've been given a name, a Tennessean, an American. And with that comes honor, but also duty. So I'm asking each and every one of you over this next week to look in and say, who is the person that we want to step forward to go up against the forces who want to centralize more power and authority? Oh, of course, for your benefit. And draw the contrast. Make the case. Americans to believe in themselves again, to have hope for the future, not based upon what government can do for you, but what we, pledging to each other, can do for America. Tennessee is part of Super Tuesday. You have an opportunity in the most watched election day of the year to speak loudly, clearly, conservatively for a vision of America that believes in the very principles that make this state a great state, this region of Tennessee a great region. Speak up clearly. Let your voices be heard. Stand for a conservative who believes in the founding principles of our country, who believes that America's days and its greatest days are not behind us, but that we can and we must, not just for America, but for the world, be that beacon of hope. Be that shining city on the hill that motivates and ennobles all of us here in America and inspires millions around the world. We have a noble cause here in America, not just to elevate the humankind opportunity here in America, but to be that what we were all called to be by our declaration, by the God that gave us these rights. So I'm asking you, between now and Tuesday, go to ricksantorum.com. Sign up to volunteer to help us. Take signs, bumper stickers. Take those signs. Put them in your window. Put them out in your front yard. Talk to your friends. I'll be taking some pictures down here at the line. Come up. Put them on your Facebook page. Tweet it out in Twitter. Communicate. Start this grassroots effort here in the state of Tennessee. It says, I believe again that we can, together, build the greatest country in the history of the world. Thank you all very much. And God bless you. Thank you. Thank you. That way? Thank you.